Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your host from SteelersDepot.com, where you can find all your latest and greatest Steelers news. It's Dave Bryan and Alex Cazzora, always Lynn, talking Steelers. And now, here's Dave and Alex.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast, Season 13, Episode 114. He's Dave Bryan. I'm Alex Cazzora, SteelersDepot.com. Thanks for being back with us here this Friday, Steelers Nation. And Dave, less than 2 weeks to go before day one of the NFL draft. And we have a jam-packed and a pretty special episode for you guys today.
Alex, all I will say to you is it is a great day to be alive today.
Amen.
How's that? Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. And so I don't want to tease it at all. I know we've already tweeted about it, mentioned it on the podcast, but I don't want to bury the lead here for any longer than I have to. We will, of course, talk about the Tanner Muse signing here in just a moment, but got to mention a little bit later in the show, Dave and I are so grateful and fortunate to be joined by legendary Steelers coach and Hall of Famer Dick LeBeau. And so about a half hour conversation, just hearing stories from Coach LeBeau, and what better way to talk to the man that way and just, you know, reminisce on his time in Pittsburgh and great defenses and great players and great memories. And so in just a little bit, we'll throw to that interview that we recorded the other day with Coach LeBeau. I have to give a big shout out to Scott Brown for helping facilitate the interview. But man, it's just, that is a bucket list item for both of us, Dave.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I tweeted about it, I think, several times over the years, how I'd like to, you know, if there's one probably person I'd like to be locked in a room with for a little bit, be Dick LeBeau here. And shout out to Scott Brown, who joined our staff earlier this offseason here as an editor and kind of an idea generator. And a lot of people probably don't know Scott Brown has authored quite a few books so far. And, you know, one of them is coming up is going to be on Dick LeBeau and specifically about that 2008 defense, as you'll hear in the interview a little bit later in this show here. And look, we would be, you know, not doing our job if we didn't help, you know, get out in front of this thing with Scott Brown and help kind of promote this book as well too. And I talked to Scott, chatted with him a little bit last night. The release of the Dick LeBeau book is scheduled to be around July of 2024, right before training camp. So if you need to start saving your nickels now, in your piggy bank, start doing it now. But I guess you're a little bit more than a year away from that happening. But and then obviously, you know, I would think Coach LeBeau will be making the media rounds, you know, as that happens. But we got him a full year out, in that. So shout out again to Scott Brown. Has been quite, you know, a heck of an addition to our Steelers Depot staff.
He has. And you guys better buy that book. I don't tell you to do anything that often, but when this book comes out in 2024, you better pick that right one up. That is one you're not going to want to miss.
Look, got to get that one on the bestsellers list, right?
For sure. It should be. I mean, a book from Coach LeBeau, the stories that'll be told there. I mean, we talked to him for a half hour and it felt like there's 100 other questions that I was dying to ask him, but obviously just, you know, only so much time. But you just have to get that book.
Yeah, look, I couldn't even make it halfway through my quiet, you know. And look, if he would have stayed on, if we would have been able to keep him, you know, another 30 or 45 minutes, we could have easily, you know, filled the time, because I had to start prioritizing my questions because, you know, obviously the time limit there. So who knows, Alex, you know, with the book release, you know, well over a year away, I have a feeling maybe we'll be able to get Dick LeBeau on again.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. But we'll throw that interview in just a little bit. I do want to start off, though, with the news of the day on Friday in Pittsburgh. A very busy free agency under Omar Khan continues. And so the Steelers reportedly signing former Seahawks linebacker Tanner Muse. Again, I assume this is a one-year deal like Watts, like Fehoko, like Neal. That's not been officially reported, but I think it's probably pretty safe to assume so. So Muse, former third-round pick of the Raiders, didn't work out there, went to Seattle. primarily been playing on special teams the last two seasons, still got a cup of coffee on defense in 2022. He'll come over with Aaron Curry, of course, was in Seattle, now Pittsburgh's inside linebackers coach. Muse, a former safety at Clemson, kind of became that hybrid guy, should be more of the off-ball type, basically like Marcus Allen, even in terms of career arc, safety to linebacker, special teams value, less so on defense, but probably a better special teamer, about as good a special teamer, without hopefully some of the mental mistakes and frustration that Allen occasionally brought. So a just fine signing by me.
Yeah, look, and this is a guy a year and a half ago I thought, you know, might be a fit with the Steelers to claim off waivers. You know, I think, what was it, around September of 2021, I think, when he was waived by the and I remember specifically because I think it was Tanner Muse's birthday, the day the Raiders wished him happy birthday on
Twitter. Oh, man.
Do you remember that? They wished him happy birthday on Twitter. And then, like, the next, I guess they didn't get with their social media department, you know, happy birthday, Tanner Muse. And then he was waived or something. I forget the, but I mean, I remember that specifically because of how that thing looked there. And then obviously landed with the Seahawks there. And it's easy to connect the dots back to him. He's a guy that we talked about way ahead of that 2020 NFL draft. And I think specifically after that Clemson Pro Day, which, by the way, the Steelers were there, right? And he's one of those planet theory guys, right? How many of those guys do you have that are, what, 6'2", 227 pounds, that had the freakish athleticism that he had there? I mean, his RAS score was off the chart during the pre-draft process. Now, for whatever reason, you know, he just hasn't been able to put it together on the, you know, as a defensive player overall, and some wondered, was he going to be a safety, or was he going to be an off the ball linebacker in the NFL? And you're right, you know, he has had kind of the career arc of a Marcus Allen there, but really athletic guy, good on special teams. Once again, I think it was something like 300 something snaps on special teams last season there. And, you know, barring him getting pushed out, you know, because of them needing a roster spot, this guy's got a pretty decent inside track at making a 53-man roster.
Yeah, I would say so. So you have an inside linebacker room of Cole Holcomb, Alandon Roberts, of course, Mark Robinson, and then Tanner Muse, and maybe a fifth guy can go ahead and latch on, a rookie type or undrafted type. So, I remember I did the report on Muse coming out of Clemson, and you know, with the testing, he was a really good athlete. It didn't always translate to the tape. I think he was a little clunky, a little awkward. There was questions about scheme fit and where he would best play, you know, in a box role, ultimately really moving to linebacker in the NFL. So I think he's always kind of maybe left me wanting more in terms of what he offered defensively in college, but obviously it's carving out that niche on special teams. And listen, you know, we talked about this probably more than a month ago. Pittsburgh, as of now, have lost a lot of special team snaps with Marcus Allen and Benny Snell and Derek Watt and Miles Boykin. And obviously, Muse is not going to play gunner the way that Boykin did, but he may replace what Derek Watt did or what Marcus Allen did as a personal protector and running down punts and kicks. And so, you know, we talk about all the losses and snaps, offense, defense, but you know, they lost hundreds of snaps on special teams. And some guys will replace that, rookies, future contracts, all of those types. But you need some veterans, some guys that have done that before, and Muse is one of those guys.
Yeah, look, yeah, you know, even Miles Killebrew last year didn't have the special team season, you know, that he had the season before there. So a lot of moving parts in that, and you got to throw a bone to Danny Smith every once in a while, right? And this is a guy that didn't the Steelers have a pro day dinner? Well, there were probably several guys at that at that pro day dinner back in 2020, and you know, from the athleticism and a use standpoint, you know, that's why pretty much why I wrote about it, you know, a year and a half ago, because you know they you know, there was a possibility of them, you know, adding another guy like Muse there, but a guy that you probably shouldn't plan on or hope not to see on the field very much other than special teams, but does have that versatility to play a couple positions if he does hit.
Sure. And listen, this team just released Jahmyr Jones, and we're not still quite sure why that was. And they did not have to release Jahmyr Jones to sign Tanner Muse, but maybe for whatever reason, Jones went out and they said, okay, we got to bring somebody in. Now, Muse is more off ball. Jones is technically an edge player, so they're not 1-1 in terms of their actual, you know, defensive role whenever they might have one, but another, you know, 200 plus special team snaps to replace. So all the more reason to bring a guy like Muse in.
Interesting thing, looking back real quick at his transition background and all, Alex, he's another one of those. He came in 2020 and was this offseason a restricted free agent, untendered. And I think he has, I don't know what he did in 2020. I'm not, seems like he was on their rut. Did he get hurt or something in 2020?
I'm not sure, to be honest. I haven't done enough of a dive on his background. He may have been. He only played like 100 snaps, I think, in 2020 on special teams.
Oh, okay.
He may have been inactive. I'm not quite sure.
Because I'm only showing regular season 2021 and 2020. Maybe he was on there on anyway. I'm trying to find out if he had another credited season in 2020. Remember, that was the COVID year. So what did I stipulate on that? Did all players get a credited season, even if they were on anyway? This should be a minimal contract. The thing is it won't be a veteran benefit contract because he's not four credited seasons.
Okay, gotcha. So well, I'm sure we'll get numbers on that here shortly, and you'll break it down sometime next week. So that is the story on Tanner Muse. I think just a fine, certainly not going to move the needle substantially, but I think an important one given all of these special teams losses.
Yeah.
All right, just to kind of bounce off of that, I've been going through my what they look for study, and today just happened to be inside linebacker. And maybe that becomes a little less relevant with the Muse signing, but still want to note the names who checked every single box in our what they look for study when it comes to the off-ball linebacker position. And there are four names in Jeremy Banks from Tennessee, Nick Herbig from Wisconsin. Pittsburgh shown interest in him. Now, he was an edge guy at Wisconsin. I'm considering him an off-ball linebacker for the NFL, his most likely position. Noah Sewell from Oregon and Trenton Simpson from Clemson, the freak who checked every single box. So those are the four names there. Herbig, to me, sticks out the most.
Yes, and here's something that's going to stick out on a news wire for you. The outside linebacker, Bud Dupree, has agreed to terms on a one-year deal with the Atlanta Falcons.
Okay, so, you know, he had that physical with Pittsburgh, left, and no guarantee, and depending on the money, depending on opportunity. That is a bit of a surprise, though. I felt like, you know, Dupree had a really good shot to come back to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, interesting indeed there. So not going to come to Pittsburgh, going to go to Atlanta on a one-year deal, it looks like here.
Yeah, so I wonder, I mean, Pittsburgh apparently never offered him a contract, never really talked numbers. Is that home for him? He's from Kentucky. What is home for
Bud? I think he trains a lot in Atlanta, doesn't he? I don't know.
Is that with Chuck Smith down there? They were in Atlanta for a while.
I think
he's from from Macon, Georgia. I'm just looking up his Wikipedia page. So he went to he's from the area essentially. So maybe there's a bit of a pull there. Obviously, you know, financially, maybe opportunity wise, the Falcons have had a lot of pretty busy offseason retooling that defense. So okay. That sounds like a homecoming, though, for Bud Dupree.
Yeah. All right. So he won't be landing in Pittsburgh after the visit there, a couple of weeks ago there. So what were we talking about? Boy, this is turning into...
There's not been a quiet day, has there?
No, there hasn't. What were we just talking about to round things out there? Oh, the study. Linebacker. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the names that check the boxes?
Yeah, Jeremy Banks from Tennessee, Nick Herbig from Wisconsin, Noah Sewell from Oregon, and Trenton Simpson from Clemson. I think Herbig is the one that really catches my eye here.
Right, and he's a guy that we talked about, too, that, you know, entering the NFL, is he an edge or is he off the ball? And he's the one that, during his pro day even, his interview with the media talked about how he's basically been told he's going to be an off the ball guy. Now, let me tell you, he's his his edge tape at Wisconsin's not too shabby at all. He's undersized, mm-hmm. you know, and that's going to make things a little bit tougher for him. Who was the kid Sutton Smith a few years ago? There was a little bit that came out that had, what did that kid have as far as sacks?
It was crazy Mac production. I forget the numbers, but yeah. It was off the charts. But he was so tiny.
Right, right. Now, Herbig's a little bit, I think, bigger than Sutton Smith is, but going to be interesting. And it's going to be one of those things with him come draft time that, you know, it only needs to be one team. You know, is there one team out there that thinks he can be an legitimate edge potentially at the NFL level, or, you know, is there a team out there that says unequivocally, oh, we you know, he could be off the ball and in the first year of transition, he can play on special teams and that kind of thing. So, you know, the stock on Nick Herbig, I mean, to me, it's all over the map. It's anywhere from fourth to, I would even say, seventh round, because maybe not that low. Let's go fourth to sixth round because of what is his true fit at the NFL level. Now, obviously, the Steelers had Curry at that Wisconsin Pro Day, and he obviously is the brother of you know, Steelers' new guard, Nate Herbig. So there is some dots to connect there. But you know, overall, just interesting to see how this guy fits in the NFL.
Yeah, in Pittsburgh, I mean, just looking at the profile, 6'2", 240, 31 and a quarter inch arms, you can't play edge on that, especially the length. It might even be a little bit less about the weight, though it is certainly part of the weight, but when you have length like that and it's just not that long, it's hard to really, you know, in the run game, you got to have length to control blocks, to keep vision on the football so those big tackles aren't swallowing you up, and you just have to be an off-ball guy. In Pittsburgh, maybe other systems that have different demands, different schemes and requirements could be something different. But I think in Pittsburgh now, you know, could you, we mentioned this before, rush him on third down in different packages. You know, Vince Williams would sometimes line up over the edge and they, you know, kind of do some creative looks on third down. So, you know, you can utilize the pass rush traits that he has, but as a down and down guy, he's an off ball player.
All right. Banks is another guy that we talked about throughout this offseason a little bit. Super athletic, but boy, he's got, you know, some off the field situation there with him. Really needs to be, I think that's kind of where we left it at, right? The off the field things with him really need to be examined.
Yeah, he's got some serious character and red flags there. And if Pittsburgh's going to be anything similar to what it was under Kevin Colbert, he's not going to be really in serious consideration for the Steelers.
Right. Now, where is the Tulane kid that Curry went down to go see at? Where does he go on the box checking?
Let me check here on Dorian Williams. Let me pull up my notes. They're not in the post for Williams. He's one of those guys that didn't do all the testing. So he didn't miss in any category that he tested in, but he did not bench and did not do the shuttle drills, the three cone or the short shuttle. And so he doesn't qualify just for that lack of testing.
Updating here, some news on Bud Dupree as it comes in. Looks like a deal worth up to $5 million.
Yeah, well, up two can do a lot of heavy lifting here. We don't know exactly. I mean, incentive based, obviously, we don't know what those numbers may mean. So, you know, it's a 1 year deal, though. And could Pittsburgh really do a 1 year deal? It might be that might have been tough to fit cap wise, depending on incentives and likely to be earned. But the structure may have been a challenge. Is that an accurate maybe way to look at that, Dave?
Yeah, because the Steelers are not fans of doing that up two kind of stuff, you know, that we talked about.
No incentives. Yeah.
And as I kind of talked about through this process, they can make it work if, you know, it was a, you know, flat out cap charge of maybe, you know, $4 million or under or something along those lines there. So and also we don't know what the outlook is as far as maybe what he's been told for playing time and because he was going to probably be a number three, right? You know, rotational guy in Pittsburgh. So maybe he's got an opportunity to see more playing time over there in Atlanta.
Yeah, he may be able to. So the combination of that, the money, the structure, him being able to go back home to Georgia are probably all factors in why he's becoming a Falcon.
Right.
All right.
We're flipping back and forth in between news and but coming out of your heck of a timing with them signing Muse this morning when you released that. Good thing you got it out of the way though, right ahead of that though.
Sure.
Do you know what does this do to really the potential of the Steelers? You know, because look, Muse is not a lock, but that special teams background certainly does give him a nice, you know, hand up, I think, on some late round competition here. I guess what I'm getting at now is if the Steelers did draft an off the ball linebacker, it feels like it would be in the later rounds, correct?
Yeah, even before the Muse signing, I kind of felt like just based on, you know, where Curry had gone for Herbig, mid-round kind of guy, Dorian Williams, we're talking third round at best, probably more fourth rounder. That seemed to be, they weren't showing interest in those top tier inside linebackers. You know, Jack Campbell at his pro day, Tomlin and Conwar, but overall wasn't getting the sense. The question is, though, would they draft an inside linebacker at all? Because you do have, you know, four guys in that room right now. You know, maybe an undrafted guy for the fifth. I mean, I've certainly had my eye and my thought on putting Herbig in my final mock draft. Do you think that is still a good way to go about that even after the Tanner Muse signing?
I was thinking about ways of potentially wedging him in.
I was thinking fourth round, to be honest with you.
As well, but now I'm not.
You're not anymore?
Yeah, not after this, I'm not. And look, once again, I'm kind of wondering where he goes at. You know, is four too early for him? You know,
I don't think so. I think fourth round is solid.
I was thinking about ways of getting him or Dorian in a mock draft, but now not so much.
Okay.
Because we've talked about how many seemingly holes, you know, ways that the Steelers could go positionally in here, and they're slowly, you know, starting to at least cover up those holes with some loose dirt, you know?
Yeah. Is that good enough though for loose dirt? I mean, that's, you know, you want better depth there, better options. Because Muse on defense, you really don't want him playing much on defense.
Right, like but during his rookie season, would you want Herbig out there as well?
Well, I mean, I get that. I mean, I understand, but, you know, would you rather have the known guy Muse probably just not going to be a defensive guy or try the unknown in Herbig and maybe you hit something?
Well, I think it goes into Danny Smith's corner at that point, you know, who he can bang the table for the special teams aspect. So once again, I up until this morning, I was considering ways of putting a guy like Herbig in a mock draft. Not so much now.
Yeah, I think it's a fair point. I'm probably shifting that way as well. All right, how far I went into the show? We're 20 minutes in. There's still a lot of stuff I want to talk about here. But
yeah, we've teased it enough, haven't we?
Yeah. So there's so much going on today, you know, that we did not expect to be talking about here last night for this Friday show. But let's dive right in, Dave. Let's throw to Dick LeBeau a tremendous conversation. Cannot thank him for his time, his, you know, being generous with his time talking with us. Again, thank you, Scott Brown, for helping to facilitate and coordinate and schedule this interview. So without further ado, here is our conversation with Dick LeBeau. And welcome back to the Terrible Podcast. And as promised, a very special guest today on today's episode of the Terrible Podcast. Dave and I are pleased to be joined by Hall of Famer, Pittsburgh Steelers legendary coach, Coach Dick LeBeau. Coach LeBeau, we are so grateful and thankful and appreciative of your time. How are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing great. Anything connected with the Steelers is always great fun and wonderfully enjoyed by me. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I want to just start off here. I know, and we have to thank our editor for Steelers Depot, Scott Brown, for putting us in touch with you, Coach LeBeau. I know he's writing a book. He's talked to you quite a bit. Can you just kind of go through the process of how the book got started and what you're kind of looking to tell, the story you're looking to tell with this upcoming book?
Well, the 2008 Steeler defense, now this is just my personal opinion, that's the best defense I've ever seen. And statistically, they've set numbers. That, you know, I came into the league in 1959 as a player, and played in the early 60s. We led the league quite a bit. And teams ran the ball 65-68% of the time and threw it 35 to, you know, what, 32% of the time. And their numbers, the guys, the Steelers' numbers, the 2008 season, were equal to, and in many cases, better than the 1963 defensive numbers. And so I said, that's kind of unusual. And I've always been a stat guy. I always kept set goals, and I've always based our team goals around validity of numbers, not just pulling something out of a hat. And when I got looking at these numbers, I said, you know, I should write a book about these guys someday whenever I retire from football. And that thought has always been in the back of my mind, the sheer numbers and the success that they had in that whole, let's say, 12 regular season and 3 playoff year, and or 16 regular season and 3 playoff year. But I always, something I wanted to do. I didn't know I'd work till I was 80 years old. And I said, well, if I'm going to write a book about these guys, I better hurry up and do it. So I solicited Scott for his expertise in that area. And he's been great to work with. And George Von Benko has also helped me tremendously. But the whole motivation behind it was the fantastic performance. I mean, you know, last year's 49ers were a great defense and their statistics were great, but they were shockingly way behind that 2008 defense. So that's what the book's about.
Coach LeBeau, obviously Troy Polamalu was part of that great 2008 defense, and everybody knows about the Hall of Fame career that he had. I want to take you back to his rookie season, though, and a lot of people probably don't remember that. You know, was it statistically a great season overall for Troy Polamalu? But then he made that jump in his next season in 2004, I believe there. And then what do you kind of, you know, What led to that second year jump that you can recall?
Oh, that's very easy to answer. I didn't get there until the second year. The Steelers actually traded up in the draft to get Troy. I was coaching in another venue at that time, and I had scouted Troy and worked him out when he came out of Southern California. And, When I got there, I knew that this guy had phenomenal talent, and I just thought it would be a matter of a little bit of patience and maybe a change of scheme here and there a little bit for him. And I one thing that I had seen him do in college was cover punts, and nobody could keep him from getting to the punt returner, and they pretty much once he became a full-time Southern Cal starter, he didn't cover as many punts as he did. But when I saw him cover the punts, I thought, man, this guy, he's phenomenal. So when I became his coach, I said, Troy, look, defense ain't any different than covering the punts. You got to locate the ball and see where the blockers are and go get the ball carrier and get him on the ground. I said, the only difference is ain't nobody punting when you're playing from scrimmage. That's all I had to tell him. Troy took over from there. But he's probably the most instinctive player that I've ever seen, and explosive. He could go from point A to point B so fast, and so many times he would surprise the receivers, ball carriers, blockers, at the speed that he moved, acceleration. And he was, 216-18-pound guy, big man, but he was so quick. And that was the thing that stood out when people watched him play. He was different than the other people on the field, and that's why he became a member of the Hall of Fame. But all the years that I was in Pittsburgh, I guarantee you, I had 1,000 people come up to me and we'd chat, and they'd say, I bet you can't guess who my favorite Steeler is. And I said, well, I bet I can. They say, who? I say, well, it's Troy. Well, how'd you know that? I said, because you're the 1,000th person that's asked me that question. But we didn't have to do much just opened the door for Troy, and he came in, set the table, and the rest is history.
Coach LeBeau, you mentioned how great the 08 defense was, and of course they made one of the greatest defensive plays, maybe the greatest defensive play in NFL history, James Harrison's pick six in the Super Bowl. Mike Tomlin was recently asked about his memory of that play. Can you take us through your memory of that play and the initial maybe surprise of Harrison dropping into coverage and the whole run back? Just what was your thoughts as you watched that play unfold?
Well, I think that is the best football, single football play that I've ever seen. Of course, it's a defensive play, and I was definitely a defensive guy. I've never seen a better one, and in my mind, that's the greatest football play ever made. Well, we had played well in the first half and had given up a couple of plays only, and one of them they scored on, and another one they were driving down in there, and they had the ball on or about our 2-yard line, and I was looking up and saying, well, I said, if we can make them hold them to a field goal here, we'll get out of here, you know, with a tie game at halftime. And I saw them, they came up, it was I think it was second down and 3 at the 3, might have been third, but I'm pretty sure it was second. Anyhow, they came up and I saw them dropping the pass, and here comes James out of nowhere and picked that ball off. And as soon as he caught it, I started hollering. Of course, you can't hear a coach on the sideline. He was in the end zone. I started hollering, "Get on the ground, James! Get on the ground, James! Get down!" Because I mean, we had it. We were out of there with, you know, having the lead at halftime. And I thought, Ben, the only thing that can happen if he runs out of there with that ball is they might end up with it and get chance to kick the field goal. And I've often shown that play to many of our teams as a motivational play. On that field, there were 11 defenders. James had the ball in his hand, and 9 other guys got blocks, and some of them got 2 blocks on that return. And the only one who didn't was way far over in the other corner when the receiver ran a corner route and almost went out of bounds. And everybody else got a block on that play. So by the time James come up to me, I was probably standing on about the 35-yard line, and I'd been hollering, "Get on the ground, James! Get down!" And when I saw he had a chance and something was opening up, I said, "Run, James! Run!" Of course, again, I don't think James heard any part of that. But every step of that way, I'll remember that play as long as I live, actually. And Harrison, he fell into the end zone on his last step. And all those blocks, and some guys got 2 blocks on that play, every one of them were critical. And in the end, that was the difference in the game. Now, Ben had the pull it out at the end of the game with a remarkable, wonderful drive. And I'll never take anything away from that particular aspect of us winning that game. And I'd say together, those two guys pretty much put the bread in the oven for the Steelers that day.
Coach LeBeau, another great player that you coached during your time in Pittsburgh, Lawrence Timmons. I remember when he was drafted. I remember the press conference that they had after that, and there was kind of the question was asked, is Lawrence Timmons going to be an inside linebacker or an outside linebacker, because he was kind of so versatile and moved around, I think, at Florida State at the time. And it's always been a question on my mind. When he arrived in Pittsburgh, did you know right away that he was going to be an inside linebacker in your system, or was there a little bit of a filling out process to see where he best fit?
Well, we drafted him early, and many times athletes that have shown enough ability and production at the college level to be taken early in the draft, a lot of times you have to take a look at several different aspects as to where they might fit into your particular defense in the best spot. And I think we went into that with an open mind. And one of my tenets as a defensive coach, I didn't ask the players to fit so much in our system as I tried to build the system around what their strong points were. And if you had a pass rusher like James Harrison, I used to try to get him rushing the passer as much as I could. We would scheme to get him on some people who would have trouble blocking them. And so we would look at the talent of the people that we had and try to build a vehicle for them to perform in. I think we did okay with Harrison, and I think we ended up with the right thing for Lawrence also. He had size, speed, great instincts, good tackler, everything that an early first round choice has. And we were glad to have him now. And then 08, I think he got to work himself into that lineup some, and we had a great set of linebackers there. And that's the best way to break a kid into the NFL, I think, where he doesn't have to start from day one, but he gets a chance to observe and practice with veteran players and see how they handle things in a game situation in a championship season where the game is actually on the line and your record's on the line for getting to the playoffs. And that he developed wonderfully. He was absolutely a great player, but I don't think you could miss on him. He's one of those guys that could have played any of those linebacker positions.
Coach, you're of course known for, you know, being one of the godfathers of the zone blitz. Can you remember the first time you called a zone blitz or a zone in a game? I remember a story of it being back, I think, with Ken Riley, and you can tell me how accurate this story is or not, but the story was Ken Riley squatted in the flat and the quarterback threw the ball right to him for an interception. But just give me the first impressions of the zone blitz and the time you realized, hey, this system actually is going to work.
Well, you have the story right, but the player isn't right.
Okay.
It was Raymond Griffin. It was Archie Griffin's brother. The Griffin brothers, I think they had maybe four of them played big college ball and on to the NFL. And their fifth brother was their lawyer and represented them in all their professional contracts. So the family was well taken care of. But the first time that we actually called that defense, we blitzed the strong safety. It was David Fulcher. Mm-hmm. And the fire zone was a product of necessity from the West Coast offense. And they had it down pretty good for when you blitz the safety or if you blitz the corner, if you blitz this backer, they would break off routes. And it was conditioned. They practiced it a lot. And they pretty much had the answer to zero blitzes. And my thought was, well, what if we created the zero blitz picture but then trapped an area that they were going to break that route off. They knew where they were going when they blitzed, so everybody was in sync. And so knowing that where they were going to go, I just did a couple of things with the players to put a player in that area with zone responsibility rather than man. And, you know, this sounds pretty simple explaining it, but I went off the diving board into an empty pool many times till I was ready to try it in a game. But the first time we ran it was in a preseason game, and the quarterback, the tight end, broke off right off the strong safety's blitz, and the quarterback led him out into the flat where Raymond was sitting there waiting on the ball, and he ran it back 45, 50 yards for a touchdown. And I said, well, we're not ready to go to the moon yet, but I think we've got something we can work on. When I finally thought that we were definitely on the right track, quarterbacks, you know, are pretty notoriously a fraternity, and they always, you know, after the game's over, they usually meet and chat a little bit. They're good, which is good. But we were playing Miami in Cincinnati in a night game. And we led, Marino was the quarterback, and Boomer Esiason was ours, two pretty fair quarterbacks. and we led the game almost the whole thing. And we had Miami bottled up pretty well. And Marino, the last quarter, the last drive really did the type of thing that he did so much of in his NFL days. He took the team down and scored, I would say, in the last 45 seconds or so, and they beat us. As I recall, it was probably 17-13 was the final score. Anyhow, after the game was over, Boomer and him were chatting like the quarterbacks did and came in off the field, and Boomer said, "Coach, I got something to report to you." I asked Marino what was he reading on those pressures, the zone pressures. And he said, Marino said, "Well, they told me a couple of things to look for in the practice and on the game film. But after halfway through the first quarter, I just started looking at my guy and throwing to him wherever he was going." And I thought, well, if Marino's just reading on the run, that's what we're trying to get done defensively, and not let them know before the snap where to go with the ball, make them read it and throw it. So I knew it was a proper thing. Just had to get enough experience and actually have enough wheels fall off the vehicle a couple of times until it was ready to play as a steady diet.
Coach LeBeau, I'm obviously biased. I believe you the best defensive coordinator this game has ever seen. I would be curious to know, was there any one offensive coordinator that you faced during your time in the league that may have had you have some restless nights before some games?
Well, any offense. I didn't never worry too much about the coordinator. He wasn't going to get out there, but obviously – you know, some of them are still in the league. When they keep winning like the Kansas City Chiefs just won another championship, there's not too many places that head coach has been that they didn't have pretty good offense. Usually when a team is productive, they've got excellent coaches, and well, always, but the players are the ones that keep you up all night, because they're the ones going to be on the field and you got to stop. And, you know, the great quarterbacks, the Peyton Manning. I never slept too well without going against him, because you could have the game won and he'd come back. And that's what the great was. I mean, I've seen them all, played against Unitas and Bobby Lane, and I'm talking old time stuff here. But they, in the fourth quarter, if they were within one touchdown of you, you could almost guarantee it was going to go into a tie game, because they just had the moxie that could take the team down there. And all of those great quarterbacks, and they're still there. I mean, it's no secret. The best teams have the best quarterbacks, generally speaking. And I would say this, I respected every offense that we had to defend. We didn't fear any, but we respected them. And we probably didn't sleep that well until Sunday night, and our game, our guys had played another good game and won for us. Because I appreciate what you said, but I'm going to say this about that, about me being a good defensive coordinator. If I had success, and I did have some, it's because I had the greatest defensive players with the Steelers that anybody will ever see.
Absolutely. Some too many great players to name. Just to kind of turn that question a little bit, I think Steeler fans, they know so well all the Hall of Famers, the big stars, Troy, others. Who is somebody that you consider to be underrated, even maybe from a Steelers fan perspective? Maybe a starter, maybe a backup rotational type guy, but somebody that was a really important glue guy on those defenses throughout your Steelers tenure. Who would you say is that a really underrated guy that does not get the credit that he should?
Well, that's an easy answer, and I'll get to that. But on that team, the 08 team is what I'm most familiar with right now, because we've been working on it for a couple of years. We had, I always say, three most valuable players, defensive players in the NFL on that team. James Harrison won, Troy Polamalu won, and I always say James Ferrier won. Ferrier actually was the runner-up his year, But the player that won it that year, we beat them three times, and our defense outscored them in every category. And James Ferrier was fantastically great the whole year and was our team captain and leader. So I always say that I was blessed to coach three most valuable players in the NFL. With that on the field at the same time, in the same defensive huddle, you're going to have some success. The veteran players that were there mostly, Aaron Smith had been there, mm-hmm. and Casey Hampton were there. James Ferrier was there. We picked him up in a trade from the Jets before I got there. And Chris Hoke was there. He was a solid defensive lineman, could play all three defensive spots. And the fourth one, when he had to rush the passer on third down, those guys, they were there. But Kiesel had come off an injury as a rookie. Woodley was a rookie. Foote had been a fairly early draft choice, but hadn't played any. Harrison, we just picked up. You know, he'd been let go five times. Ike Taylor was drafted late from Louisiana school and was a kickoff returner when I got there. And, of course, Troy, you talked about his first year was not he didn't exactly set the world on fire. Deshae Townsend had started, I think, a couple games, but was mostly a nickel player. McFadden and Will Gay were young players. We had picked up Tyrone Carter from Minnesota. He was a very wily veteran, solid guy. And Anthony Madison, I think from Alabama, he played as a extra corner. The defensive lineman like Kirksey and Eason, who we picked up as free agents, and Lawrence Timmons, who was a young, promising player. All those guys contributed to setting marks. I really don't think anybody else is going to ever touch them again. Records are made to be broken. Maybe somebody will. But the most undersung player of all that defense, in my opinion, is Ryan Clark. And Ryan, Coach Cowher was looking for a safety. He thought we needed a safety, and he gave me the assignment to look at all the free agents that were available that year. And I did my due diligence, and I said, Coach, I think Ryan Clark is the guy who would fit in with what we do and the way we adjust and move and disguise. And I see him. He doesn't miss tackles, and he's smart. He's obviously can make all the checks. I don't see him out of position, and I think he would really be a good safety for us. And where he filled this out was that Troy was so creative, in his extemporaneous adjustments to the offensive formations and the pictures that he was seeing, and he could just react so quickly. And I don't know really how they communicated exactly, because I watched him practice every day and I would watch him in the game, and I could never see really exactly what the heck they were doing. But wherever they went, they were like joined at the hip, and Ryan always was there if Troy needed him. And together they gave us easily the finest pair of safeties in the league for so many years. And you don't really hear anybody talk that much about Ryan and Troy, of course, because of his great play in the Hall of Fame. And I think that he would tell you that Ryan is a big part of him being in the Hall of Fame.
Coach LeBeau, we're winding you down here. We'll squeeze one more in possibly with you here with the 2023 NFL draft approaching here. Question I always kind of wonder, does pounding the table for a player in the draft room happen? And can you remember an instance maybe in a draft room when you were with the Steelers where you were pounding the table, if indeed that happened for a particular player?
I've not seen too much pounding on the table, particularly in the Pittsburgh draft room. Things were always pretty well organized. And you meet and then you rest a minute and then you meet. So by the time the draft comes around, every point of view has been pretty much hashed over. I do remember one story. I had coached in Cincinnati quite a few years, and Ben had played at Miami of Ohio. Mm-hmm. And in the MAC conference, they were one of the first conferences to play on any night of the week to get national television. And they were on television on the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday night, you'd get a MAC game. And I got to watch Ben play. I think he came out as a junior, so I got to see him play 3 years. And I was struck by how, you get some pretty raw weather in western Pennsylvania, where Pittsburgh is, and in Ohio, where Ben was. And I saw how he played under adverse weather conditions. I never seen a quarterback play with any more control of the ball and could execute and keep the offense moving. So we were talking about they had three great quarterbacks in that draft, Rivers from North Carolina State, and I think Eli Manning, and Ben. I might be off, but I think I'm right on that. And we were rating these guys all the way through because we were going to take a quarterback. We were drafting pretty far down, 18th or something like that. And we didn't know if any of those guys would get there, but if they did, we were going to take a quarterback. So at the end of all these draft meetings, you'd say you get a vote, and when they categorize and they go on, and the only vote that really mattered was the GM and the head coach, but we all voted. So we're going in to the last, and the vote would always come out the same. Rivers was the guy we were going to take, and Coach Cower, he wanted to make sure that everybody had their ducks in a row. So he said, we're going to meet one more time on this quarterback situation. And we were all sitting at a big, long table. And Bill said, now, I want to hear from everybody. I want everybody's vote on who we should take here if they get to us. And Bill turned and he looked at me and he said, I don't want to hear from you, LeBeau. I know who you're going to say. So that's as close to pounding on the table as I ever got. That was a head coach pounding on me to shut up. As it worked out, and all of the gold and black nation will be forever blessed, the other two were gone, and Ben was still there, and we took Ben. And he turned out pretty good, I think.
Yeah, he did.
You're right. It was the 04 draft with Manning, Rivers, and Ben, and it's one of the wildest drafts with the Manning-Rivers trade. Just one last question for you, Coach LeBeau, and thank you again so much for your time. I got to ask you, though, can you share a favorite Dan Rooney story, a Rooney family story, being part of the organization for so long and knowing the Rooney family, I would assume, so well? Is there one instance of probably the many of the Rooney family, just the way that they go about things, the way they run an organization, the way they treat and take care of people? Could you just share maybe one story that you remember from your time in Pittsburgh?
Well, they're just an outstanding family and outstanding people. And they run their organization like they would a very tight-run family operation. And I think truth is the key word that I would say. I've never had any Rooney say anything to me that didn't come to pass if they said something was going to happen. And I think that the very fact that, in terms of patience and trust, the Steelers were, for a long time, were not a real successful franchise. Mm-hmm. And they were still managed correctly. They were still very ethical. They were very, very physical and combative on the field. But the 70s group, I lived through this, and And that group of people, you know, Bill Nunn was one of the unsung heroes there of helping to pick out outstanding athletes for them. And that group of athletes that they got in the 70s, where they became the boss of the NFL, that's what turned the Steelers into, you know, the Steeler Nation is, it's everywhere. It's all over the world. You can say it's all over the country. It's all over the world.
Right.
And they were the first ones to really have the tremendous success. And really, along with some ups and downs that come with any athletic franchise, the Steelers have pretty much remained right at the very top. So I think that there was a combination of talent, meeting, expert management. And I always felt that everybody under that roof was part of the Rooney family. And that's the way they operated. And I'm sure that's the way they still do.
Absolutely. Coach LeBeau, cannot thank you enough.
Absolutely.
So thankful for the time to talk to us. We cannot wait for the book that comes out with Scott and the stories you'll tell about that 08 defense. Again, just thank you so much for your time and talking with us.
Well, I enjoyed talking with you guys and meeting you, and I hope we meet again down the road somewhere.
And welcome back to the Terrible Podcast. And Dave, what a joy, what a treat that was. And again, there's 100 other questions I really wanted to ask Coach LeBeau, but you know, just really thankful for him taking the time to talk with us, share those stories, to talk about his players. And I think you had mentioned it after we did the interview the other day, just how humble and selfless he continues to be, certainly deserving of all the credit, all the superlatives in the world. And he's somebody who's always deflecting and giving credit to others.
Yeah, look, that was my main takeaway. And it's not a surprise, right? You go back in time and remember, you know, the interviews that he would have, and he'd always talk about his players, you know, and as hard as you tried to get Dick LeBeau to talk about himself and the great things that he obviously did, you know, not only as a player in the NFL, but also as a defensive coordinator and head coach and all like that. I mean, it keeps going back to the players there. So, and look, I, you know, just to give people heads up, I wanted to, you know, some of the questions I have here in front of me still that I wanted to ask him, you know, 62 career interceptions during his NFL career. I wanted to ask him about his favorite career interception of all of them. I wanted to ask him about the pro day memories, because remember, Dick LeBeau was a state at the Ohio State Pro Day. Dick LeBeau was there, you
right.
know, and you know, obviously going back several years trying to remember the other pro days, but I was going to ask him about the pro day process and the value to be gained there. Was going to ask him about the smartest young player that he ever coached, you know, film wise, study what, you know, who came into the league that he coached that was, you know, didn't need the coaching up on the film. Was going to ask him about that. And finally, I was going to ask him kind of an out the door question. You know, he was drafted into the fifth round in 1959 by the Cleveland Browns and cut as a rookie. I was going to ask him, how did Cleveland mess that one up?
In typical Browns fashion, even for that.
Right, time. Right.
Yeah, I wanted to really ask him, and I was the last question I was debating, and I'm sure people will say I should ask the other one if we get Coach LeBeau on again, you know, maybe next year I'm going to ask him just about, you know, relationship with Tomlin and kind of the mesh between, you know, Tomlin being a Dungy guy, Bud Carson guy, you know, Tampa 2, cover 2 versus LeBeau being, you know, 3-4 fire zone, how they kind of tried to make that work. Obviously Tomlin retaining LeBeau whenever he was hired in 07. I wanted to maybe get LeBeau's thoughts on that, but ended up asking the other question there at the end. But again, you know, just great answers and talking about Ryan Clark. And the thing that I'm not that I'm surprised by, but the thing I noticed the most talking with Coach LeBeau is just how sharp his memory is. I mean, ask him about the first time he ran a fire zone. He can tell me who the safety was, who the quarterback was, who the corner was, the exact play. I mean, he's 85
years old.
Have
you been
able
to find, you found that clip by now, right?
You know what? What happened was, because whenever I asked the question, I phrased it this way to ask about the accuracy, because in Tim Layden's book, Blood, Sweat, and Chalk, one of my favorite all-time football books, he describes the story of LeBeau first time running the Fire Zone, and it mentions Ken Riley. And I think I remember going back and trying to find that, and that something about the timeline didn't make sense to me. So I wanted to ask Coach LeBeau, and it wasn't Ken Riley. It was Archie Manning, something in there. I forget what the name was.
Wasn't it Griffin? Archie Griffin, right?
Okay, the interview was a couple days ago, so I'm trying to think back to the specific
name.
One
of the Griffins.
Yeah, you can see how much better Coach LeBeau's memory is than mine. You know, right. Something that happened 50 years ago, and I can't remember what happened 2 days ago in our conversation.
Was it Ray? Because I'm looking here. I forget. Did he mention it? Was it Ray Griffin? Yeah.
Was it Ray Griffin?
Yeah, Ray Griffin was a former cornerback, younger brother of two-time Heisman Trophy winner Archie Griffin, and also played college football with Ohio State and pro football for the Cincinnati. I think it was okay. Ray Griffin he mentioned, wasn't it?
Yeah, that sounds right. So anyway, for him to recall that kind of stuff. And I have not looked up that play. I probably shouldn't need to, because I remember trying to find it with Ken Riley and coming up empty. So something to do. And then I love the answer on Troy and how he just kind of got Troy to – everything's a punt, Troy. Just attack it like you do in the punt game, and that kind of helped turn his whole career around.
Right. What is he, 85?
85, yep.
Man.
And you wouldn't know it, though.
I believe he's still active on the golf course and all like that as well, too. So good for him, man. He's lived a life, hasn't he?
Sure has. And so hopefully you guys enjoyed that. Certainly a treat for us, I'm sure, and hope that it was a treat for you guys to hear from Coach LeBeau. So let us know your feedback on that. And if we ever do get the opportunity to talk to him again, let us know what you would like us to ask. If you could ask Coach LeBeau one question, what would it be? I'm sure you guys have a lot of thoughts there.
Absolutely. And once again, shout out to Scott Brown for making that happen.
All right, Dave, to finish up the inside linebackers, Devin Bush speaking with the Seattle media yesterday on a radio show hosted by KJR's Ian Furness, and had some comments about his time in Pittsburgh, really twofold of the notable comments that Bush made about the Pittsburgh Steelers. A, was asked about, you know, how different the culture is in Seattle versus what he experienced in Pittsburgh, and Bush said it's 180-degree difference. Did not go into details about what exactly that meant, but we can maybe surmise, obviously, Bush quickly fell out of favor with the fan base and ultimately with the coaching staff as well. And so a fresh start in Seattle. The most notable thing that was gaining all the headlines on Twitter, social media last night was Bush when asked about why Pittsburgh didn't pick up his fifth-year option. Essentially, why didn't they try to keep him around? Bush saying, apparently, sincerely, I don't know. I've never been told an answer. I wish I knew why he was not kept. And I think the answers, even if you're the biggest Devin Bush fan in the world, are pretty obvious to why he's no longer a Steeler.
Yeah, look, he could have done himself a favor and answered that question a little bit better, you know. And you know, you got to understand probably why he was asked that question the way he was. And to me, he would have been better off saying, look, you know, that's in the rearview mirror now. They made their decision. I'm trying to move on. I'm working hard this offseason to take another step forward. And, you know, I'm excited about, you know, he could have played that off a lot better. But the way he answered it kind of made it its own little story, if you will, there. And now I think later on in the interview, didn't he say something about, you know, he did have conversations and all like that. But look, it wasn't even hard. And remember that his fifth-year option was due a full year out ahead.
Right.
But at, you know, it wasn't a big surprise. I mean, that season that he had came off of in, what would it have been, 2021
was the decision year, yeah.
Obviously, wasn't great, right? You know, and it made the Steelers' decision really, really easy not to pick up that fifth year option on him. And then fast forward through 2022, he never really technically has lived up to anywhere close to being the first round pick that you know that he was and all like that. So his exit from the Steelers this offseason shouldn't have shocked anybody overall. And you know, he's going to be playing against obviously a great talent there in Bobby Wagner in Seattle. And it'll be interesting to see, you know, how much, you know, how that impacts his play.
Yeah, and people think that we're dunking on Devin Bush, and I think the comments he made about, you know, being mystified of why he didn't get the fifth-year option picked up, why he wasn't retained, I think they're pretty silly. I think they're obvious, but I'm not mad at Devin Bush. I wish him well. I want him to succeed in Seattle. Maybe he will. I think the change of scenery, you know, will be good for him, not having the weight of expectations of that first-round pick, trying to fill Ryan Chazier's shoes, which was a monumental task. It may help Devin Bush, and as you said, playing next to Bobby Wagner in that different system, again, may all be good things for Devin Bush. But let's just not pretend that we don't know the reasons why it didn't work with Devin Bush. They're pretty obvious. And it's not entirely Bush's fault. He got hurt. He tore his ACL for a speed guy like that. That's a very tough thing to come back from. And I commended Devin Bush for, you know, doing all he had to do to get ready, to get healthy, to start week one in 2021, to be ready for training camp even. So I think he put in a lot of work there to try to get his body ready, but it wasn't the same guy. They maybe, you know, loss of confidence in that knee. I'm not quite sure. But, you know, he didn't play well. He got hurt. It was going to be, you know, the money to retain him. The reasons why Devin Bush is no longer a Steeler are obvious to anyone. And they should be obvious to Devin Bush as well. All he had to say was, you know, it just didn't work out. I got hurt. You know, didn't have the best season, and it's a business, and they moved on. That's all you got to say.
Right, right. And plain and simple. And he's now in new territory. And I think we haven't come across it yet, but I think he had a Zoom meeting yesterday with the media in addition to that radio interview. So we might spend today trying to look for that, comb through that.
Just to bounce back to Bud Dupree one last time, according to Jeremy Fowler, and I'll just read the tweet here verbatim from 3 minutes ago. Quote, the Steelers were heavily in the mix on a Bud Dupree deal, but Dupree preferred a one-year deal. Steelers prefer two-year deals on contracts of substance, so Dupree is off to Atlanta. And so, again, I think contractually, the one-year deal with the incentive language, something that Pittsburgh not willing to do, kind of similar to Terrell Edmonds. Less money, obviously, but, you know, Edmonds taking that deal with the incentive-based seems to be, you know, the reason why Pittsburgh isn't retaining some of these guys.
And look, didn't I say during this process here that, you know, the Steelers might be angling for a 2-year deal to try to keep that first year cap hit down, yes, and that Dupree probably was angling for a 1-year deal so he can potentially maybe get one more bite of the apple a year from now.
Right. 2-year deal kind of locks you in. If you have that bounce back type season, you're not going to be able to capitalize that from a market perspective or agency perspective. So, yeah, I think that I tweeted out a little bit ago the reasons why I think Dupree, you know, is going to Atlanta is the contract, maybe a bit more opportunity for playing time at Atlanta, and Georgia being home for him are probably the three main reasons why he's a Falcon instead of returning as a Steeler.
You know, they could have very easily done something around, you know, a 2-year, $12 million contract with him, you know, with $6 million in year one, and in essence, still keep his cap hit under $4 million that way. And, you know, I think we covered that in the way the Steelers might try to attack it with him if indeed he wanted more than, let's say, $4 million in a single year. So I believe every bit of what Jeremy Fowler's just reported about 4 minutes ago. And I also believe the fact that the reason why Bud Dupree turned that down is the fact that he just only wanted to do a 1-year deal so he could potentially take a bigger bite of the apple a year from now.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. All right, Dave, get back to Steelers news here in terms of some draft coverage. I think yesterday, we'll see about today, but yesterday, Thursday, might have been the final day for Pittsburgh to host some pre-draft visitors, and they had a pair in West Virginia wide receiver Bryce Ford Wheaton and Bowling Green defensive lineman Carl Brooks. Now, I believe that Ford Wheaton is a local visit because he's from WVU, does not actually count against that allotted 30. Brooks obviously does, and so those are potentially the last two. Maybe somebody comes in today, but typically I think, you know, I'm expecting Thursday to be that last day of those visitors to come in.
Yeah, I think unequivocally today is the last day, isn't it? Or was yesterday the last day? It's one of the two, because now you're in that 2-week window of the draft. Now, I don't know if Zoom meetings can be done, you know, from this point forward or not. And didn't we come across the kind of the older news yesterday when we were chatting that is it 3 Zoom meetings that teams are allowed in addition to the top 30 visits, or is it, you know, how many Zoom visits can they have?
It is 3 1-hour Zoom meetings that teams can have. Yes.
Okay. All right. So I think now we have the list. Now the only thing is can we go back and find the guys that, quote unquote, reportedly were set to come in? Did they come in?
Sure. Guys like Daywon Jones and Kelee Ringo, players that reportedly were
Jervon Dexter, too. We don't have a date on Jervon Dexter, do we?
Correct. We do not. Now, I will say, I believe visits can technically go into next week. I saw that Will Levis, CJ Stroud have visits set up next week. So, are those, you know, maybe.
I don't know if those are workout. I don't know. But
I don't know if they're workouts. I think they're visits. Now, I think Pittsburgh typically, just historically, have kind of ended about 2 weeks before the draft. And so that's why I say I think maybe Thursday, Friday is going to be the last day for them. Obviously, quarterbacks, different case because they are so busy and they're doing so many things, wearing so many hats. So I'm not going to say 100% guaranteed they're done, but you know they're at like 28 names that we know reportedly or confirmed to come in. So if they're not done, they're pretty darn close.
It's been a long time since we've had, confirmed in list this long, I think, right?
2019, because you had the COVID years where there weren't any. Last year, we only knew 13, and most of them were quarterback-driven. And so, yeah, you have to go back to 2019 for the last time to have, like, a really full set of visitors listed out.
All right. Bryce Ford Wheaton, contested catch guy, athleticism off the charts. He's got some drops in his tape, you know, a guy that I remember looking at back at the Shrine Bowl weekend. Seemed like he predominantly played X, but did move around, did play a little bit in the slot, did play, I think, a little bit as a Z. So he's got some position flexibility with him, proximity being so close to Pittsburgh, and obviously with him, you know, playing against Pitt and all like that. They've got to know a lot about this kid at this point. I believe it wasn't it Mike Butler at his pro day?
Yes, it was Butler and maybe Casey Weidel. I'd have to go back and check, but at least Mike Butler.
All right, so he's a guy that could potentially be in the mix for the Steelers in the middle of rounds, and would Carl Brooks. I mean, that's not surprising at all because Carl Dunbar was at that pro day. He's a guy from a measurable standpoint that sort of checks a lot of the boxes there. So Carl Brooks coming in out of Bowling Green, not a huge surprise.
No, it's not. And this is not brand new this year, but I've seen a lot of guys where positional coaches go to a pro day and then that guy comes in for a visit, like Zavala, the guard from NC State. Pat Meyer was there. He came in for a visit. Carl Brooks, another example. I think there's a couple others. But Brooks, you know, I just talked about on Wednesday's show that after signing Fajoko, signing Watts, kind of getting those base nose tackle, one tech types, could this team look for more of that three tech pass rusher with some juice? And Carl Brooks, I think, was a name that I mentioned and kind of really one of those guys. And so he's got high level production in the MAC, really good athlete, was a linebacker, initially bulked up, you know, playing more inside, but still rushed off the edge quite a bit at Bowling Green. So he's, you know, really active hand use, a guy that can certainly get after the quarterback with a hot motor. So, you know, could that be a guy in, say, round four. Three? Are you thinking four? Yeah, four. Three, four, something like that for Carl Brooks. Yeah.
Yeah, if they don't grab one in the first two rounds, he becomes you have to think he's in their sights in the middle rounds there.
And then with Ford Wheaton, I have not studied him intently, but you know, obviously the RAS scores off the charts, height, weight, speed guy. But I know some people have concerns. Does that really translate to the tape? And does he get separation? You know, is he another one of those classic guys that looks good running, but really can't separate and you know doesn't pan out because of that?
Yeah, look, but the Steelers do like those contested catch guys. Now, unfortunately, though, there are some nasty drops in that tape.
Mm, okay, fair enough. Is he kind of mid-round? What do you peg his stock?
Yeah, probably fourth. And, you know, obviously the Steelers don't have a fifth or a sixth right now. But a guy that I would say anywhere from the fourth to late fifth. Maybe if he slid early sixth, but this isn't overly – it's kind of a – this wide receiver class isn't great top to bottom overall. And it's not top heavy. And there's a lot of those, you know, fourth, fifth round guys that teams could utilize.
Sure. Gotcha there. Gotcha. All right. Good deal. All right, Dave, you dove into some tape last night, some Lucas Van Ness. And so kind of explain the background of what got you diving into his tape on a Thursday night and your takeaways.
Yeah, and we had previously talked a few times, not at great depth, about Lucas Van Ness and, you know, early in this kind of pre-draft process. And it was kind of Ray Filippato from the Post-Gazette was on 93.7 The Fan. And for those that don't know, I think right out of shoot with one of Ray's early, or maybe his first mock draft even, I think back in, I don't know, January, he had Van Ness as the Steelers' 17th overall pick. And, you know, they kind of recirculated Ray's thoughts on him. And Ray still firmly believes that Van Ness could be in the Steelers' sights at 17 overall. Now, without a doubt, from a lot of the Blues Clues things that we like to look at, I mean, they were at the Iowa Pro Day. I think from an athletic standpoint, Van Ness checks a lot of, you know, all the boxes, probably, if you look at that aspect. I think the bulk of our conversation early was the build with him, you know, the weight specifically, and what is he? Is he an edge? Is he an interior, you know, defensive line guy? And, you know, I had already watched, I think, a game and a half of film on him prior, you know, to all this, but I wanted to go back last night and say, am I missing anything here? You know, and we had a quick little DM chat, you know, on Twitter yesterday afternoon. I said, look, I just need to, you know, dedicate an hour to this guy. One of the things I want to talk about first and foremost is what is he at the NFL level? And if you go back and you look at, and here's the thing, the last two seasons at Iowa, he never hit the 500 snap mark in his two seasons at Iowa. Okay. Mm-hmm. And they played in each of those two seasons, I think, you know, what, a total of 1,800 defensive snaps or something like that. So, you know, he played why did he play half the snaps?
Yeah. Well, I think the story is there is that I was very old school and the seniors get to start and the underclassmen rotate in. And so that's kind of the way they do things, right or wrong. And that's kind of the system they have over there in Iowa.
Okay. But, if you're an ass kicker, so to speak, you're going to be on that field. To me, you know, I don't know why you don't put your best players out there more, you know.
No, it's fair. It's still a smaller sample size for us to watch, regardless of the reason.
Sure. Okay. So you've got, let's call it not even 1,000 snaps over two seasons. All right.
Okay.
I think around half of those, around 500 something snaps, were him in the B gap.
Okay.
All right. I think another 200 and something of them were him, maybe a little bit more than that, were him either outside of that or outside the tackle and more kind of, a wide nine. Okay. So there's not there's not a lot of tape of him overall as an edge. Okay. Now you look at his sack reel overall, there's a very few amount of what we would deem high quality sacks in there overall. Now, without a doubt, this kid uses his arm. He's got long arms, and he's got a hell of a bull rush off of that. He's got a good get off, especially from a down position interior offensive line. So he uses, you know, I think the thing that you'll notice that sticks out the most on him, either in lined up inside or outside, he's got a hell of a bull rush. Not much bend that I can see overall. Not much of a pass rush menu out on the edge. And now he can separate, you know, against the run by using those long arms once again, against the run and all like that. I just wonder, you know, my main takeaway from him is there's a lot of bits and pieces from from the along the defensive line and out to the edge there of good tape with him overall. You better have a plan of what he's going to be at the NFL level. And I also went back and I last night I watched a little bit of an interview, a podcast interview that Thomas Dimitroff did. Mm-hmm. This offseason here, and obviously former GM, and people can say, well, he's a former GM for a reason now. Okay, I get it, but this is a guy that's been in the NFL circles here. And here's the other thing about real quick about Van Ness is like I think like something like a 33% pressure rate, you know, which is incredible, but mm-hmm. you're dealing with a smaller sample size there as well too, you know. Dimitroff, in so many words, said, look, you know, how are you, if you're going to draft this kid early, especially first round, how are you going to get him on the field for more than 40% of the snaps? You know, and what's the long-term outlook for him? Let's say specifically if he was drafted by the Steelers. He's a kid that went from like 240-something pounds up to 270. What is he? What was he at the combine? 74, 72, 76?
272, yep.
272. You know, ideally for the perfect Steelers defensive tackle, those guys get up closer to 300, right?
Yeah, I just don't see him having the – I mean, he's got a frame, but to become you know, like a 295-pound guy, then you worry about you know losing athleticism. To me, if he were to be drafted in Pittsburgh, he'd be an edge. I mean, he'd drop down to 260, 265 and be a big edge rusher, more so than an inside guy.
Okay, let's assume that would be the case. You know, do you have enough edge tape to project him out at the NFL level, you know, as a first-rounder?
Sure, it sounds like there's not enough tape at any one position to really get a great evaluation of him, regardless of what role you want him to be in, just because he's not played a ton of football based on the kind of antiquated way that Iowa does things.
I'm not saying this kid's not talented. I just, if you're a GM and you're picking in the first round with a guy that played not even 500 snaps, and it'd be one thing if he played all 500 at one position too, you know, but sure. they moved him up and down that defensive line. To my main takeaway is this is a kid that could get you fired.
Okay.
You know, you damn sure better be right with the projection. He's a projection kid, I think. At this level, I'm not saying he won't become great at the NFL level because there's a lot of good. There's a lot of good aspects in his tape. And this is what Thomas Dimitroff's takeaway was as well, too. He says he's a good player, but is he a very good player? You know, can he become a very good player? Mm-hmm. And you better have a damn specific plan in your projection with him, and he better hit it because of the tape limitations that you have on him and the positional – how much he moved around, it makes him an incredibly hard player to project at the NFL level.
I know that lines have blurred between 3-4 and 4-3, even fronts, odd fronts, you know, defenses are multiple, but I view Van Ness as that classic 4-3 base defensive end, 6'5", 272, 34-inch arms. That seems to be the system he's going to fit the best. And I think you're right. You know, he could be a good player, you know, a 5-6 sack a season type of a guy. But is that a first round pick that you're going to hang your hat on? And especially in Pittsburgh, if he's an edge guy, automatically a number three is the value in terms of what he's going to be able to offer you from a snap count perspective, what he's able to do, what his ceiling is. I don't know if that makes sense for me.
I was thinking, OK, well, where would I take him at? And this is in no relation to what he won't become or will become or anything like that. I couldn't get out of my head the fact that because he's such a projection guy, yet there are good traits there that I don't think I'd touch him until the third round.
Okay. Wow. Gotcha. Where would you play him if you were an NFL team trying to evaluate what position he plays best, regardless, even putting Pittsburgh aside for a second, just overall, what is his best NFL scheme fit?
it feels like it would be a base end, a 4-3 base end.
Okay. Yeah. Strong side, can play the run, strong dude. You know, going to get your 5-6 sacks, not going to have a 12 sack type of season. Be solid, but is that, you know, top 10 or 17 worthy?
Who's the Bengals end right now?
Hendrickson?
Not Henderson. Hubbard? The other one. Hubbard.
Okay. You seen some Sam Hubbard?
Yeah. I kind of get that feel out of him. Of a ceiling.
I like that. It's a pretty good comp. Yeah. I'm down with that.
You know what I'm saying? So
You'd be Trey Hendrickson to get your 12 and a half sacks, but Sam Hubbard would get your 5-6, you know, sacks.
And look, this is a guy that even might can come into the NFL in limited snaps, you know, as a situational player, especially as rookie season, get you 6 sacks.
Yeah. Here's my counter to all of this, though, putting just the tape aside. So why was Pittsburgh at that Iowa Pro Day? Why did Mike Tomlin and Omar Khan make the trip to Iowa?
It might be, and we'll obviously find out, but it, you know, there are a lot of players there, right?
Well, I mean,
Riley
Moss. Yeah, but when they go for the top dogs. They go for guys that, I mean, because obviously the correlation between the first round.
Jack Campbell there. Don't you have the tight end there?
Yeah, there's talent. There's for sure talent. But, I mean, they go to places that have a lot of talent, like you're mentioning, but also, you know, first round guys are really looking at. They want to get eyes on. And Van Ness is going to be the only first rounder.
Could have been a time killer on the way to Iowa State to see the wide receiver.
Well, I viewed it as like Iowa State was just because they were in the area. Because why go to Iowa State? Because what first round guy are they looking at there? Will McDonald? I mean, it kind of also calls into question that.
All right.
We're just two weird trips.
We have 2 weeks to find out, maybe to circle back on this kind of stuff to put the pieces back together from what they did. But my take, and look, I mean, they've already got DeMarvin Leal, right?
Right.
Who weighed slightly more than Van Ness did, you know, coming out. And we still don't know what Leal is, right? And how would drafting Lucas Van Ness impact? Not that you matter. I mean, you get the best players out there, right? And I mean, but it kind of makes the Leal. It would make you question the Leal selection even more.
It's a little hat on a hat, kind of getting similar guys, a little betweener, trying to, you know, play outside, kick inside. It's all a little redundant. So let me just ask you. Do you think Van Ness is in serious play for Pittsburgh at 17? I know we're all guessing. No one knows, and he checks the boxes, but is he a real option if he's there at 17?
Look, this all you set me up to get hung by the tongue here, but
I'll say it first. I don't think he is. I might be wrong. I may come back and be bitten on.
I say unequivocally no.
Okay.
Now, if he is, I mean, people have heard our reasons. This is why I wanted to go back to him, because, you know, Fittipaldo talked about him, you know, yesterday, and we talked about him early in the process and kind of threw the baby out with the bathwater, right? You know, so to speak there. But you look at the other Blues clues that we go by with, you know, athleticism and pro day and yada, yada. And he checks all the, but good kid. I mean, very clean prospect as far as I can tell, you know. But I thought we owed it to, you know, ourselves and the listeners to circle back and have a good conversation about him.
Sure. Because he does check the boxes, regardless of what we think, what we like, what we don't like. He checks the boxes and what a Pittsburgh Steelers first round pick is.
Now, if he is the guy at 17, God bless him. I would be interested to hear what the plan is with him.
Sure. Let me throw out one more name at you in a similar vein.
If he weighed like 12 or 13 more pounds right now, I might feel, you know, but even so, you know, the amount of snaps and all like that, he's an incredibly hard projection player from where I sit for what the Steelers do.
Well, if he weighed that 12 or 13 more pounds, he'd be the guy I'm about to talk about, Keon White from Georgia Tech, who I think is most interesting because there are 17 prospects who are been invited and will be attending this year's draft. And probably the most surprising name of that 17 is Keon White, who we viewed kind of more solid day two guy, but not really in the first round conversation for the draft. Invite him. They're typically pretty good about getting the sense of who's going to be first round picks, maybe early second round picks. So for Keon White to go, I know 17 is a big stretch. They were not at that Georgia Tech Pro Day, but White, let's just talk about him in general. And that even at 32, if he does happen to be maybe that one guy that falls out of the first round, I mean, he, you know, trying to find that body type, 6'6", 285, 34 inch arms. Pittsburgh brought him in for a pre-draft visit. There's some interest there.
Yeah, that's another interesting one. And I haven't gone as deep on his tape, obviously, now at this point, as because Van Ness became my hot button yesterday.
Right. Now, White's got the production. I think he's a senior. He's played more football. I don't have exact snap counts in front of me. And I need to watch his tape, you know,
Let's circle back to that next week.
Okay.
Because I want to dive deeper into his tape.
Okay, fair enough. But I do want to mention that because I thought the draft invite was really interesting because, and sometimes the NFL misses, and generally there's about one guy that the invites that becomes a second rounder. Last year they invited the quarterbacks and Corral and Willis, and those guys tumbled into the third round. So it's not 100% guaranteed, but you know, you would say that White would be a top 40 pick if he's getting the invite to the draft.
Now, he's more of an edge than Van Ness is coming out, though, isn't he?
No, I think he'd play inside, 285. I mean, you bulk him up a little bit, he'll be interior guy.
All right, so let me dive back down because I think I've only done kind of surface stuff on him, and I want to dive deeper into him like I did with Van Ness. So let's do him on Monday or Wednesday of next week. And right. He'll be another guy, I think, in the round table next week that we discuss too, right?
Yeah, a week from today, we'll have our last draft round table with the rest of the guys whose names are escaping me right now. We'll have Jonathan and Josh and a couple other guys on as well for a round table right before the draft starts.
Okay.
All right, last thing I want to talk about really briefly here. Big Ben in the headlines, his podcast, last episode of the Football and Podcast or Vlogcast, whatever you want to call the thing. Went up and Ben had some words about Lamar Jackson, saying the teams don't fear his accuracy, fear him from the pocket, the way that they do him as a runner. Our Matthew Marksey wrote about that. And lo and behold, the rest of the NFL world caught on to those comments and started writing about it as well. RG3, you know, criticizing Ben for tearing down Lamar Jackson. Obviously, Jackson, a hot button name right now, given the whole contract situation. So to me, I think it's all a bit blown out of proportion, but what are your thoughts here, Dave?
Real quick, I just pulled up some alignment stuff on Keon White. B-gap over a course of three seasons, 19, 2021, 2022. What was the deal with him in 2020? Do you know?
He's an Old Dominion transfer kid. I don't know if he had gotten hurt or actually was there even Old Dominion playing football in 2020? I'm not entirely sure.
So at in 19, 21 and okay, let's take his last two seasons in, right?
Yeah, I don't know how much he played in 21, but definitely played a fair amount in 22.
In 21 and 22 combined, B gap snaps alignment 44.
Okay.
Over the tackle, 108 snaps. Outside the tackle, 499.
Okay, but he's 285. I mean, is he going to play on the edge in Pittsburgh?
Well, I guess that's another one of those going to be another one of those projection things, right?
I guess, but I mean, because when they drafted Leal, he was 283. They wanted to play him inside. I think with White at 285. In terms of, I'm talking about like NFL projection, I think he'd be more inside.
Okay.
But he'd have to drop down, you know, quite a bit to play on the edge in Pittsburgh.
All right. Well, then we're back to not a lot of tape of him doing that.
Yeah. I think, again, trying to find those like base ends in Pittsburgh
it's
is
tough
now.
To
do. Yeah. There aren't many body types like that.
Right. And it has been for years now. That's why when you go even, you know, when we come out of the season and start getting ready for the Senior Bowl and taking a quick look at this class, You can't help but immediately go to, you know, the Senior Bowl measurables on a lot of these kids, right? You know, start looking for what matches up, and you know that's why you come away with those with the Bentons
mm-hmm.
and You identify early the guys like Javon Dexter and the guys like Brzee when it comes to that body type. But as we've seen over the last several years, those Cameron Haywards just don't come. Those Cameron Haywards and Stephon Tuitts just don't come out every year.
Right. You know? They're getting rarer and rarer to me as guys get smaller. And
which makes you wonder, maybe they are adapting some of the things that they're looking for.
They could be. Absolutely. It's tough to replace a Cam Hayward when it comes time to replace him. But yeah, I just see Keon White, you know, just a listing 6'6", 285, 34 inch arm. You try to make him, you know, a 4-eye and playing inside a bit because he's got a size that and a length that most people don't even have, because Dexter and Brzee, they don't even have that kind of length. They're pretty short. So, I mean, it's like White and Benton and Mazi Smith in terms of the guys that have really good length that could play inside.
All right. Sorry to interrupt you, but I pulled that up. Where were we?
On Ben and Lamar, just your thoughts on, you know, Ben's comments that have created this internet firestorm.
I mean, this is what Ben does best at times. And I, you know, does he specifically do? I think what he meant to say was, and you know, part of the quotes back this up there, you're more worried about what Lamar Jackson does with his feet.
Yeah, that's how I took it. Yeah, this is maybe an overly simplified comment, but basically just saying like Jackson is at his best when he's able to be dynamic and scramble, extend the play, and you know, that's what he's proven to do. So I didn't view it as this hypercritical.
I think the way he worded it, you're not concerned about him as more of a pocket passer. He could have done himself a better favor by not saying that specifically.
Yeah, I think, like I said, I think he was oversimplified in kind of the analysis. I don't think he was trying to offer this like super hypercritical analysis either of Lamar. And he probably could have been more careful with his words, but I didn't see it as you're tearing Lamar Jackson down. This isn't, you know, Bill Polian telling Lamar Jackson to go play running back or wide receiver.
Right. But it is easy to frame it that way.
Oh, yeah. If you take the clip out of context in 18 seconds and nothing else. And then you got people with the stats about, you know, look at Ben's QBR in the pocket. Hey, Ben never said he was a good pocket player in this context about, you know, older, the further you go back, you know, completion percentage is lower, quarterback ratings lower. So over time, numbers naturally go up as offenses become more refined. I think it's a little silly there. So, you know, to me, this is kind of all a silly story.
It's white noise in April. And when it comes out of Ben's mouth on a podcast, it's easy to make it a national story 2 weeks ahead of the draft when it's mock draft city right now. Right.
Sure. I'm with you there. So I just want to mention those comments and, you know, to me, it's a story that'll go away by tomorrow, by the weekend, but it's out there right now.
Right.
All right, Dave, hey, jam packed show today. Anything else here that I'm missing that you want to get to?
I don't know. I think we tore it up pretty good, didn't we?
Yeah, I know the show's running a bit longer today with the LeBeau interview, but I think we'll make the exception there, of course, for Coach LeBeau. So let's get through some reader emails and close out today's show, Dave.
All right. Xavier Robinson writes in, Dave and Onyx, thank you guys for tremendous offseason content. Nobody is as in tune with the Pittsburgh Steelers and Steelers Depot team, and that becomes more clear each offseason. Thanks for that, Xavier. I hate mock draft season. He says, I hate mock draft season. I hear you, Xavier. But the one thing I do pay attention to is the Vegas odds. He says right now they have the line for Joey Porter Jr. at over under 16.5, with the betting favorite being over, meaning picked after pick 16. Vegas believes the Steelers are probably going to have Joey Porter sitting there for them, and I think that's the most likely scenario. It is where need, value, familiarity, and talent all intersect at the highest point. It simply makes the most sense. He says, if you guys were to bet on Joey Porter line today, would you take the over or under 16.5? He says, I believe the best tackle available would be the pick at 32. You've detailed all the options very well, but could you talk more about Anton Harrison? Have the Steelers been reported to have met with him at any point? Yeah, they brought him in for a pre-draft visit. What is your opinion on him? Thanks for answering my questions. Oh boy, that's an interesting line at that 16.5. And I don't know, Alex. My gut tells me to take that he would be on the board at 17, essentially. So taking the over at 16.5, but he was a guy that's been invited, one of the 17, at least that we know of, that's been invited to the draft. There's a couple of teams that you think, man, will he make it past them kind of thing? But just my gut makes me feel he'll be on the board at 17. So I would take the over. Anton Harrison, a talented guy, both played on both sides of the line at Oklahoma. You could definitely see why he is in that next tier of tackles, I think. And the Steelers have had some interest in him in this pre-draft process.
Yeah, and a left tackle. And it'd be an easier, I think, try to fit him in there to battle Dan Moore than playing right tackle. And how do you move Chooks, who's going to start, and try to make him left tackle? And if the rookie doesn't work out, then Okorfor's got to flip back. It becomes messier to handle all that. Yeah, with Porter, I'm really kind of on the bubble with that one. I wonder, is he going to get William Jackson by Washington at 16, who need a corner? And that's kind of where, you know, a lot of teams are, or a lot of mocks are projecting Porter to go. But obviously, you know, it'd be no surprise if Porter was the guy, just given all the dock connecting that we can do when it comes to him. And listen, you got four quarterbacks that are going to go, you know, maybe two corners and Witherspoon, Gonzalez, Will Anderson, Carter. Does Porter get pushed down and all of that? He might. So I'm very much on the fence about that. And just one other piece of news, because why not for today? Not related to the Pittsburgh Steelers, but the Pittsburgh Penguins have fired Brian Burke, Ron Hextall, Chris Pryor, so the Penguins are cleaning house.
All right. I'm guessing Mike Sullivan survives, though, right?
They've not mentioned Sullivan, so it appears that he's staying. At the very least, no announcement on him today.
All right. Daniel Wilson writes in, with all the interest in the day two guards and no tackle depth, do you think Sayamalo will be playing tackle? My first answer to that would be no. Dan Moore then becomes a swing, and then Herbig Dotson and a rookie compete for left guard. Just a thought. Obviously depends on how the draft goes. Sayamalo is not a tackle.
Yeah. I mean, he played some there at Oregon State, but NFL, he's a guard. He was signed to play guard.
Right. Brett Nile, Dave and Alex, quick question about three remaining free agents. He says, I have to believe Tomlin wants Benny Snell back, but he has not been signed. Do you think Snell's camp is waiting till after the draft to see if they can find a spot where he can get more playing time? Do you think he will ultimately sign back with the Steelers? He's got a kind of a company question there. Are you surprised Boykin is not re-signed? He says, I am. Do you think it's about money or playing time? Again, do you think he will sign with the Steelers after the draft? And number three, are you surprised that Rudolph is signed, not signed anywhere yet? He says, I won't ask you to rehash the past, but do you agree with me that the longer he stays unsigned, the more likely he is to become the number three quarterback by the end of training camp? He says the draft coverage has been fantastic, and while I really miss hearing from Dave T. Thomas, may he rest in peace, I think he'd be proud of the job you guys have done, and generally, especially the roundtable discussions. Just wanted to say, look, I've thought about Dave T. Thomas several times through this process here. Throw one name out, get five back. You know, and we do miss, there won't be a draft that goes by, or a pre-draft process that goes by, no matter how long I live, that I won't think about some of the great discussions we've had with Dave T. Thomas over the years. Alex, roll through Benny Snell. Look, Benny Snell, I think Mike Tomlin does want it back. This might be two-headed here. I think the Steelers will probably sign him back tomorrow if he'd sign a 1 year veteran benefit contract with no signing bonus. And I think the same probably goes for Miles Boykin as well too. So how much of this is related to Snell and Boykin saying, yeah, let's just wait, you know, and see how the draft play. There's no reason to think they wouldn't want those two guys back, at least for camp, on minimal value deals, to see where it goes.
Yeah, I think you're 100% right about that. Both quality special teamers, both quality locker room guys that have carved out a niche on this team. But as you said, you know, those guys can probably wait. Those offers are probably on the table. They're not going to go anywhere. So, you know, just, you know, see if anything else comes up. If you're Snell, if you're Boykin, just kind of, you know, you're not in a big hurry to go sign that low level type contract. With Rudolph, I just don't see him coming back to Pittsburgh. I think eventually, you know, quarterback gets hurt somewhere. I am a bit surprised, I'll admit, that he's not signed somewhere by now. Probably one of the best free agent quarterbacks still out there. But I mean, he comes into Pittsburgh, he knows he's the number three. He knows he has really no chance to play unless there are serious and multiple injuries, just with the way that, you know, he probably thought he was treated in Pittsburgh. Not that fairly, didn't get a really, you know, fair shake. Right or wrong, that's probably his feeling. And so, you know, do the odds go up? Sure, but it's some, you know, 1-2%. So I just don't see him coming back to Pittsburgh.
Oh, we got a couple more pre-draft visits in today, after all, Alex.
Okay. Why not?
Yeah, hosted. We're timing these perfectly. Cedric Tillman coming in. He's a Tennessee kid, right? And Felix Aduke Uzama. Tyler Wise is getting a lot of his guys in the door this year. Look, I looked at Aduke Uzama. When did I do that? Around one of those all-star games and all. He's a guy that we talk. He's an edge rusher, obviously, more than anything. Very, very talented guy. Did not stand up a lot, though, at Kansas State there. So, but very, very productive guy. A guy I think at the combine they probably even put through those kind of dropping drills and all like that. I mean, you could really see him as a developmental outside linebacker, if you will.
Yeah, he's a guy with good production. As you said, Tyler Wise, a fan of him. Tillman was a guy that, you know, has some size. He was the guy that I thought was smaller, but he's bigger. He's, you know, well over 6 foot with some decent speed. Obviously, Jalin Hyatt kind of gets all the press there in terms of Tennessee wide receivers. So, yeah, another mid-round type of guy, and that's kind of been Pittsburgh's MO and the receivers they have looked at, and Charlie Jones and Jaden Reed and, you know, Mingo kind of more mid round. I think he's going to go a bit earlier than people think, maybe late, you know, round two, early round three, that kind of range. So that's kind of the type of receiver they're looking at right now.
Absolutely. So ending the week with actual Friday. I can't remember the last time this team had Friday pre-draft visitors.
Yeah. And assuming the ones that have been scheduled actually came in, that should get us to 30. Cause I don't believe Aduke Uzama nor Tillman were known before. And so I was sitting at 28 heading into today. And so that should be 30, assuming that all the others reported actually, you know, have come in.
Right. So what does that mean for the ones that were reported?
You would assume that they came in. I mean, I don't know for sure, obviously, but if you assume that the ones we don't know about the exact date, Day One Jones, Dexter, Clayton Tune, Ringo, et cetera, if they did visit, then you add Tillman and Aduke Uzama, there is your 30 visits. And then this means Pittsburgh will be done.
Okay.
All right. So we have a full list.
Let's see. Yeah. With Mason Rudolph, he's got such a bad taste in his mouth. I mean, we'll see. You know, I am a bit surprised that he hadn't found some place to land just yet. So we'll have to see. Might be a situation where he's waiting until after the draft to maybe decide. I don't know.
Sure.
Nick Shuley writes in, Alex and Dave, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Steelers need to use one of their first picks on a stud corner to help keep the lid on the likes of OBJ, Jamar Chase, Amari Cooper, etc. They haven't drafted a corner that has made a Pro Bowl since Carnell Lake, he says. Why do you guys think they've struggled so much drafting corners? Also for Dave, can you explain a little bit more on your old school Parcells theory on why you wouldn't draft a corner in the first round? Look, the old Parcells theory mostly, I think, goes to top 10, top 15 picks. And Parcells just used to say, look, you either get a franchise quarterback, you get a franchise player that can protect the quarterback. And back in his day, that meant left tackle, or you get a franchise guy that can get after the quarterback, meaning an edge rusher, was his philosophy there. I just, you know, and his theory pretty much being the closer to the ball, you know, kind of players from there. I just, you know, and it's not as deep as the whole running back thing there. I just think, especially the way rushing coverage goes hand in hand, I just have been less excited about drafting cornerbacks in the first round than I have throughout other areas of the draft. Specifically, not that you can't get a good one and he paid dividends for you and all like that. It's just been one of my hangups, one of my biases, if you will. And look, we haven't talked often, obviously, about the Steelers drafting a cornerback in the first round. You know, already burned several years ago. We all know how that worked out there overall. And you know, we'll see what obviously happens. Look, I think there is a very high probability that they will draft a cornerback in the first round this year. Whether that guy be Deontay Banks or Joey Porter Jr., or they, maybe they trade up for a guy like Gonzalez or something like that, you know, there. So now why have they struggled so much in drafting corners? I mean, if you look just at positionally overall across the NFL, when it comes to cornerbacks, I mean, a lot of teams miss on these guys, you know, overall. Now the Steelers have had successes in the past, right? You know, guys like Ike Taylor, guys like Bryant McFadden, you know, they've done pretty well on William Gay. I mean, for as late as he was drafted, end up, you know, being worth his weight. Right. It's just, you know, people immediately, then you go back to the Cinquez Golson who never got on the field. Right.
Yeah, never even for a preseason game. 7 training camp practices for him. I would say there is no clear-cut answer for why they've struggled. If they knew the answer, they would have addressed it, fixed it, you know, a decade ago. I would say two things. A, to Dave's point, there wasn't necessarily a ton of high-end capital in cornerback and first, second-round guys. You know, so when you get into the mid, late rounds where they kind of focus their cornerbacks, you know, your success rate is naturally lower. But still, they were drafting guys that would get cut immediately and just fall out of the league, you know, after August. I mean, you know, Shaq Richardson and Terrence Frederick and guys like that. So to the other point, it's the same answer I give you when people ask me, why are the Steelers so good at drafting wide receivers? I don't know what it is about the evaluation of what they're doing. I don't think it's anything unique and special and different. I just think for receivers, it was the same scouts that watched Plexico Burress and, you know, were around Hines Ward and were around Santonio Holmes and all those guys. They were the same scouts that were watching Antonio Brown to Juju Smith-Schuster to, you know, all those guys, because Pittsburgh's personnel in the front office until 2022 rarely had any changes. And so when you had the same scouts that had the eye for the receiver in 2004 and in 2017, you had the same process and the same people, and just in the way that led to success at receiver, you had the same scouts that were watching the cornerbacks that they failed on, and Ricardo Coakley watching Artie Burns, and so you just had the same people and a similar, you know, opinion and thought process and evaluation process, and so that just kind of how those guys were wired. They had a better eye for receivers than they did corners for whatever reason, and to me it was just a product of the scouting department staying in place, and they were good at some things and weren't good at other things, and that was reflected over time.
All right, well put. Jeff Arbogast, we'll make this the last one here. Hey guys, I was just wondering how the center class looks in this year's draft. I think this is a position of need for the team. He says Cole has been serviceable, but isn't the quality of player that the team has had in the past. I would say, you know, overall, this is a good center class overall. I think it's more top heavy than it has been in the last 2 or 3 years, at least, I think. I think they're going to draft one.
How early is the question?
I think it might be earlier than most people think. And I'm really starting to wonder about if they're, how early they might take a tackle if they don't trade up and get, you know, the Georgia Kennedy, Paris Johnson or Broderick Jones.
So you're thinking it could be a center high and a tackle later?
I'm really starting to wonder if they might not draft a tackle at all. I'm starting to wonder.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, as we've said all along, they have shown a ton of interest in the interior offensive line. And I think Cole did fine at center, but sure, he's not elite. He's not Marquise Pouncey. He's not the next great Steelers center. And I just don't know if it's worth the upgrade there, but
I could see them drafting, you know, one, not in the first round, but anytime after that, one that they think that could A, push Cole this year and potentially be the future guy past this year.
Any particular names you're kicking around?
I think John Michael Schmitz is right. Potentially maybe a guy that could be in their crosshairs. And it all goes to when is he, you know, how far will he fall? You know?
Okay. So you're thinking 32?
I don't think it's out of the question. And I think 49 is definitely in play if he were to last that long.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, it's something I really wrestle with, and I got to think about it for my last mock. You just look at it on paper and say, you know, on paper, you think the tackles are going to be weaker than the interior guys after all the upgrades you've made there. And you just wonder, is it worth to go back into the well of trying to get another center who may not even start in your
number one? I mean, Ricky Stromberg, I think he's got to be in the conversation there a little bit later. Who else? I mean, Avila still feels like more of a guard though, right? Even though he's got center in his resume, doesn't he have more of that in his build and his play more sensible for guard?
Yeah, he's like 330. I mean, you don't see a lot of 330 centers in Pittsburgh. They haven't always been the biggest guys, but you know, in Pat Meyer's system, the centers are doing a lot of one-on-one blocking as the guards go help the tackles. And so a center that can have good anchor and sit is pretty important.
Right.
So it's a big question. I'm still wrestling with this one.
Do you think they're going to draft a center?
Yeah, I think at some point the answer to throw my own question in my face is how early will they do it is the million-dollar question.
All right. We got through those. I think we're right at about the two-hour mark in this show. We've been kind of careful not go that long as much as possible lately, but I think with good reason here, we had a 30 minutes with Dick LeBeau there, and we had some news that come in throughout this thing as well here too. So unless you got anything else, Alex?
Nope. We'll wrap things up and come back.
We even got some Penguins news in there today.
Yeah. I mean, just literally all the news, at least it was during the show and not after, as it usually seems to be.
All right. You can follow me on Twitter at Steelers Depot. Follow Alex on Twitter at Alex_Kozora. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do and want to donate to the cause, go to SteelersDepot.com. Hit the donate button up right navigational bar. Also, if you want an ad-free version of the site, SteelersDepot.com. Hit the ad-free button up right navigational bar and follow the directions that way. Shout out once again to Scott Brown for making this happen with Dick LeBeau. A lot of great stuff on the site today. Hope you're visiting SteelersDepot.com. And busy week next week. We have a round table scheduled as well too. A lot of pre-draft talk along those lines as well too. So as always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Alex.